Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
You may have heard recently of the decision of Britain's King Charles to decommission the Royal Train, a series of railway carriages rather than a trailing garment. This is being done as a cost-saving measure and ends a tradition in his family dating back to 1869 and his great-great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. Now, you might think that it's far from such notions our brave republic has conducted its business, but you would be wrong. I'm talking about carriage number 351, or the Irish State Coach, to give it its full title. Like so much that was luxurious in the early Irish state, this was a legacy from the previous regime, specifically in this case, King Edward VII. When His Majesty eventually succeeded his mother, the aforementioned Queen Victoria, one of the first items on his agenda was a visit to his Irish subjects. And since, to borrow a phrase from a later popular song, he wanted to see all of us, means had to be found to convey the royal party around the country in the style and comfort to which they were accustomed. His mother had travelled by rail when she came to call on us in the middle of the 19th century, but that vehicle was no longer fit for purpose. So the Great Southern and Western Railway was tasked with building a carriage fit for a king. In the run-up to the royal visit in July 1903, every glorious detail was picked over by the loyal press. The carriage was 50 feet long and over 12 feet high, with a clerestory roof to maximise natural light. It comprised a large central reception room with a smaller smoke room at one end and a boudoir at the other, each with its own lavatory. The main saloon was decorated in the fashionable Art Nouveau style and comprised rich wood panelling throughout, moulded cornices and pilasters, bevelled mirrors, gold detailing and painted designs of interlaced roses, shamrocks and thistles. Over one end, a painted figure of an Irish piper and at the other, a harpist. The carriage was judged a great success, far greater than the motor car used to convey their majesties, which broke down in the wilds of Connemara. Sadly, though, there were few opportunities to use this opulent conveyance in the succeeding decades, especially with the change in administration, and it fell into quiet disuse. That was until another important visitor came to call, a papal legate, the Armenian Cardinal Agajanian, sent by the Pope to the Patrician Congress of 1961. This prompted authorities to refurbish carriage 351, presumably in a slightly less lavish fashion, and to dub it the Patrick Chariot for the occasion. Thus rehabilitated, 351 went on to play host to visits from Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia, and former President Dwight Eisenhower of the USA. But it was another president, Eamon de Valera, who really brought the state coach, or the presidential saloon, as it also became known, back to the limelight. Already in his 80s, he found the presidential Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith no match for the roads of 60s Ireland, and for longer journeys, much preferred to take the train. And indeed, it was credited with helping to secure his re-election in 1966. As incumbent, he had been advised not to campaign actively, but with a plethora of 1916 commemorative events to be attended all over the country that year, he was a very visible presence. For the last 3 years of his presidency, de Valera was accompanied on his rail trips by my father, in his capacity as head of information for CIE. On one journey, the president told a story no one had heard before. In his time as commandant of the Boland's Mills garrison during Easter week 1916, he was on a scouting mission to Westland Row railway station when, overcome by tiredness, he went to sleep in a carriage on a siding. When he woke, he thought himself dead and in heaven, surrounded by angels. Above him, he could see only nymphs and cherubs. He was, of course, staring at the ornate ceiling of 351, the royal coach, as it then was. The state coach was withdrawn from service in the mid-70s to be replaced by a newer model. It was stored, sometimes outdoors, at Inchicore Rail Depot and narrowly missed being destroyed by fire there in 1991. Following this near disaster, work began to properly restore 351 under the auspices of the Railway Preservation Society of Ireland. The venerable but still serviceable piece of rolling stock was relaunched by President McAleese in the year 2000 and is still brought out for special occasions, such as the celebration of 175 years of the Inchicore facility. A fitting final destination, I think you'll agree.
You may talk of Columbus a-sailing across the Atlantic he'll see, but he never tried to go railing from Menace as far as Kilkee. You run for the train in the morning, the excursion train starting at 8. You're there when the clock gives the warning.
It was when I climbed into the attic to put away the Christmas decorations that I spotted it. Lying back against the far wall, beyond an old iron bedstead and a heap of picture frames, I crawled very carefully from rafter to rafter until I could reach it. As I drew it towards me, the memories came tumbling out of it one by one. It was your old school bag. Do you remember it? The one Grandma Devlin bought for you. I can still see it on you. You were completely dwarfed by its size, either side sticking out way beyond your little shoulders. She got it for you the week before you were to begin school, and you wore it all day, every day, running around the house with it hopping up and down on your back. You even took it up to bed with you at night, tucking it tightly between you and the wall beside your bed, covering it with the red crochet quilt. You said you loved the smell of it, all new, all waiting for you. It was brown, made of canvas, with two shoulder straps and two shiny buckles that you managed to open and close, your little hands working away until you'd got the hang of it. You asked me to make your sandwiches, even though you weren't due to begin school for another week. You just wanted to put them in the satchel, and off you went, out into the backyard, where you'd take them out and eat them, as if practicing. You couldn't wait to start school. It was to be a Thursday, so you'd only have 2 days of school and then Saturday and Sunday off, beginning in earnest on the Monday. You went to bed all excited on the Wednesday night. Your clothes had been placed carefully on the old yellow chair in your bedroom, all ready for the off next morning. A green knitted jumper, soft checked shirt and brown corduroys, brand new Clark shoes for your feet. Your dad and I were sound asleep when you came bouncing in to our room at 5:45 and asked, was it time to get dressed yet? Would you be late for school? We pulled you onto the bed and into the gap between us, trying to snuggle you down in the warmth. And we even managed to get a little more sleep. But you couldn't settle, fidgeting and tossing about. So at 6:30 we gave in, and we all got up. You ate your porridge, a big lump of honey in the middle of it, something you loved. School was due to begin at 8:30, but you were ready at 7. Can we go yet? Being repeated over and over. OK, I said reluctantly at 8:00. We'll go now, but there's no hurry. Really, there's lots of time. I had looked forward to this stage in your life. It would be good for you to mix with other children, and I would have a few hours off. But now it all seemed to be falling a bit flat. I was the one feeling edgy and nervous, it seemed, not you. I'd made you jam sandwiches, your favourite, the sweet dark thickness already beginning to seep through the fresh white bread. You put them in their brown paper bag and into your school bag, along with an apple and a small container of milk. Your dad had bought you a wooden pencil case that had two layers which swiveled apart to reveal coloured crayons, pencils, a rubber and a parer. You loved it. That went in too. The school was only 5 minutes' walk down the road, past the gate to the big house where the donkey lived, on past the block of flats and beside the old church. You knew the way already. As we set off, I held your little warm hand in mine, loath to walk too fast, trying to hang on to what was going to slip away as soon as you entered the school. You jumped and bounced, hopping over the cracks in the pavement. It was unlucky to step on a crack, you always told me. It seemed that I was the one that was creeping like snail unwillingly to school. I tried to slow you down, just a little, but as we walked through the gates, you could see lots of other little boys and girls running and skipping around the playground, and you were away and into that other world. I suppose I should have been happy, knowing that you would be well looked after, that this was what is supposed to happen. But somehow I wasn't. I felt my little anchor had slipped. I was adrift, floating on a tide that I'd never known before.
Lunch blessing. Two lizards speed away at the sound of our feet. Trays of aubergines, their golden hearts, olives, mozzarella, all carried from over the fields, from women in the tiny market to here. A drip of oil, a string of spaghetti spills onto the scorching stones. The Siamese cat pounces. We sweat in the heat, sweat with the meats, our friendship abundant as platters on this long table. Later, three white butterflies will lead us all the way up to the old walled town. But for now, breadcrumbs fall like summer snow on our Czech tablecloth. The half-moon windows are netted against us ever having to leave. And the bells of Sant'Angelo are ringing their blessings on us all.
If you take a scove around my neck of the woods, St. Luke's in Cork City, and wander up Grattan Hill, you will find near the top, on the wall of a Georgian terraced house, a sign that reads simply, 1811 to 1863, William M. Thackeray, writer. Local information is scant, only that the writer William Makepeace Thackeray at some point lived in the house. Being a fan of Thackeray's Vanity Fair, I decided to investigate. I discovered that he married a Cork woman, the beautiful but fragile 18-year-old Isabella Shaw, whose family came from Donrail. He met her in Paris in 1835 when he was trying to be a painter. Having developed an early talent for carousing and gambling, Thackeray had by then squandered his inheritance. Isabella's family was living in straitened circumstances in a boarding house near the Champs-Élysées. Her widowed mother intended Isabella to marry money, so she strongly disapproved of Thackeray. But he was smitten. He wrote to Isabella in April 1836. "So, dearest, in a few months we will go and be married and have children and be happy ever after as they are in storybooks." They did marry. They settled in London and were happy for a time, but they did not have the storybook ending. Mrs. Shaw was an extremely difficult mother-in-law. Time and again, we meet her impaled, as it were, on Thackeray's sharp nib, most notably as Mrs. Baines in his novel Philip. She had a bad and violent temper, a shrieking voice, and two manners, the respectful and the patronising, which were both odious. After her third daughter was born, Isabella became mentally unstable. Under contract to his publishers to write a travel diary about Ireland, the Irish Sketchbook, and badly in need of money, Thackeray was at his wits' end to find care for Isabella and the children. Isabella's mother was by then living on Grattan Hill, so he decided to take Isabella and the children to Cork and leave them in Mrs. Shaw's care while he travelled throughout Ireland gathering material for the book. Things went horribly wrong. On the boat journey to Cork, Isabella threw herself overboard and was in the sea for 20 minutes before being rescued. Somehow the hoops of her petticoats had kept her afloat. At Grattan Hill, a hostile Mrs. Shaw refused to have Isabella under her roof. So Thackeray had to find lodgings across the way in the house that now bears the plaque. Travelling around Ireland was out of the question for now, as he was constantly on duty at his wife's side. They stayed a month until he managed to get the children to his mother in Paris and Isabella back to England for treatment. He returned to Ireland in 1842 and spent 4 months touring and writing the Irish Sketchbook. I read the sketchbook with mixed feelings. Thackeray's skill as a writer is surely in his satire. Here, however, as he describes masses of people, poverty-stricken, dirty, begging, mostly illiterate, his satire feels akin to joking at a deathbed. He depicts pre-famine Ireland as a country of premature ruin, priest-ridden beyond all bearing, a Gothic world of mud cabins, half-built churches, towns with empty warehouses, villages with staring faces, hotels without waiters. But I did enjoy his description of his stay in Skibbereen. At the inn, he was shown into a dirty coffee room with a strong smell of whiskey. But dirty as the place was, his mood improved when Dan the waiter served him an exuberant dinner of trout and Kerry mutton. The following morning, he awoke with the pangs of hunger beginning to make themselves felt. But despite several applications to a bell, no member of staff materialised. Finally, he was obliged to make a personal descent to the inn kitchen, only to find the entire staff crowded into the pantry, oohing and aahing in admiration of an infant. For Thackeray, Dan's pantry was a wonder. Here lie bread, blacking, fresh butter, tallow candles, dirty knives, all in the same box with snuff, milk, cold bacon, brown sugar, broken teacups and bits of soap. No pen can describe that establishment, as no English imagination could have conceived it, he wrote. In Cork City, he revisited Grattan Hill to meet with Mrs. O'Mahony, the penniless widow whose house they had lodged in on that first visit. In contrast to his mother-in-law, he described his landlady's warmth. How much goodness and generosity, how much purity, fine feeling, nay, happiness, may dwell under the threadbare coat. The Irish Sketchbook was well received and established Thackeray's reputation as a travel writer. But his later feelings about it may be detected in a comment he made to a friend sometime after its publication. "I am beginning to find out now," he said, "that a man ought to be 40 years in a country instead of 3 months. And even then he wouldn't be able to write about it."
I think it was the verb to rob that appealed to us young boys. The notion of robbing orchards seemed to be the closest we would ever get to being Jesse James or Billy the Kid. They galloped across the screen in Technicolor in the Castle Cinema. We galloped home on our imagined horses, knowing the only adventures that lay ahead were getting through a school week without being slapped or robbing an orchard. And there were orchards aplenty to rob. Never mind that most of us had apple trees in our own gardens. The stolen fruit was sweeter, juicier, redder, rounder, and had the added value of being robbed. The word had a ring to it. It spoke of bravado, of danger, of the possibility of being caught, of a solid kick in the backside from a farmer, of word getting back to our parents, of, God preserve us, a call to the house from Guard O'Connell or Guard Casey. But there was one orchard we didn't rob and didn't dare rob. It was a grove that housed just a couple of damson trees. It wasn't that we didn't love damsons. They were exotics in our lives. At a time when plums were unseen and unheard of among our little gang, when ice cream only appeared in shops from May to September, and when the only television we knew of was in Cope's shop window, damsons were several steps above apples, and yet we never robbed that orchard. When I think about the reasons why, they restore my faith in the inherent goodness in humanity. Even when humanity is a raggle of 10 and 11-year-old children whose only stimulation is the weekly matinee. A taggle of individuals who were excited by the spectacle of a frog on the road. Our reasons for never robbing the damsons went unspoken. The possibility was simply never raised. The garden would have been an easy target. The trees were just inside a hedge that was easily breached. Indeed, the branches of one of the trees grew out above the road, and the orchard was only round the corner from our homes. A minute's run would have taken us from Abbeylands to Woodlands. But that robbery would never happen. The little damson orchard was owned by Eileen Kelly, and she lived in the cottage whose plot housed the trees. Eileen was one of those quiet, self-contained women who rarely drew our attention but always received our respect. To have stolen from her would have been to cross a line that was neither beaten nor drilled into us. The respect came from some inherent recognition of the fact that she was a decent, hard-working, kind person who went quietly about her work. She was one of those people who have an aura about them that speaks of dignity and grace. She was a woman of distinction, and that distinction didn't come from wealth or social position or status within the community. It came from her goodness and quietness. And so we clubbed our halfpennies and pennies together and knocked on her door and asked if we could buy some damsons, please. And Eileen would weave a cone of paper from the previous week's Nationalist and Leinster Times and fill it to the brim with the sweet, shining damsons. And while she did, she'd inquire how our parents were and how school was going. Were we enjoying the Indian summer? And always, once the cone had been filled, there was an extra handful for each of us. And we left with a thank you, Miss Kelly. And we carefully closed the garden gate and went on our way, happy in the knowledge, though we couldn't articulate the thought, that we had done the right thing. Eileen Kelly died on a Monday in early March of 1980. I was teaching in the local vocational school by then, and I didn't get to attend her funeral. But I did recognise that her death had taken one of life's gentle, humble and quietly memorable people from our little community. Since then, I've sown an orchard in the garden of every house I've ever owned, and I've always included one or two damson trees among the apples and pears. A living reminder of a woman who made her quiet and influential mark on at least one childhood life.
Soon after I moved to Ennistymon, I realised I needed a party piece for that fine old tradition of sharing a song or recitation at a gathering is alive and well in the West. And because I do not sing well, I chose to learn Seamus Heaney's Postscript. It is, after all, a Clare poem, familiar and loved by so many people across Ireland and the world. And sometime, make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore, Heaney tells us, and we enter the soothing magic of his poem, voyaging at once to that rocky curve of land between the Burren Mountains and Galway Bay, where the ocean is so often, as he said, wild with foam and glitter, where white swans do eternally swim on the slate-grey surface of Loch Maree in an echo of the children of Lear. I learned the poem off by heart, tutoring myself from recordings of Heaney's voice, and it wasn't long before I was offering it up at a party in a house in the hills above Milltown Malbay. At the party, there were a large number of men from many different corners of the world. They were living as asylum seekers in Milltown's Direct Provision Centre, a run-down hotel where they slept four to a room and existed in a kind of limbo that Heaney might have described as neither here nor there. A fire blazed in the grate, and though the party grew hot, a young man from Georgia did not take off his Cossack hat all evening, not even when he stood up to recite what he said was a national poem. Its lines were full of passion, and though none of us understood a word he said, we all deeply felt how much the poem meant to him and his people. All that night, and for weeks afterwards, I was haunted by those dispossessed men, and I remembered something of how it is not to belong anywhere. And I remembered how my own life was when I first encountered Postscript. 30 years ago, the poem used to hang on a wall beside a departure gate at Dublin Airport, a hurry-through place. I was then in a dissolving marriage with a baby and a toddler, and things were bleak. I had always dreamed of being a writer, but was as far from writing as any person ever can be. Once or twice a year, I managed to take my small children to visit their London grandparents, and on the wall of Dublin Airport, I would always read Heaney's Postscript, and even in my sadness, it managed to reach me and give me shelter. And once, In the rootless, difficult years that followed, I was travelling back to Ireland with the children and stuck in the slow hours of waiting for a delayed flight. And there, across a too brightly lit airport cafe, seated at another plastic table, were Seamus and Mary Heaney. And I was nothing to them, a young woman across a room, struggling to keep her small children entertained, still not writing. But time passed. My children started school. I began to write, stories and poems, word by word, line by line, traversing boundaries, closing vast distances of time and space, until my writing brought me, once more, into the Heaneys' company, into their kindness. When we met at festivals and readings, Seamus and Mary greeted me with the same generous respect they offered everyone, Seamus taking your hands in his and holding them warmly, pressing your fingers as if he wanted to let you know you were someone he really wished to talk to if only the duties of fame weren't calling him away. Those demands of fame meant his time was always accounted for, his calendar always full. My friends, he told us, are kind enough to leave me alone. But Seamus Heaney did not leave us alone. He stayed among us over and again, stepping through theatre dark into the harsh glare of spotlights to recite again the poems we wanted to hear, midterm break, and when all the others were away at mass, and always postscript. I think he loved postscript most of all. He said that after a drive into the West, the poem had come like a quick, sidelong glimpse of something flying past, a sudden glimmer of earthed lightning. But he recognized its power and knew it could deliver us into the intense landscape of North Clare and stop our great hurry, buffeting our hearts open, so that whatever our origins, whatever our destiny, we might for a moment be stilled and brought back home to the person we were meant to be.
Masterclass for Hubert Conaty. On Fridays, the master would lower the whole world down on a map for all of us to see. From the question mark hook, he uncoiled the cord, brought it down to earth from its high ledge. I watched Australia, New Zealand, Antarctica disappear in accordion folds of blue, seismic waves swelling, tectonic plates shifting, and swallowing up the names of islands I'd not heard of before. I rolled them out on my tongue to hear the sounds of faraway places. Vanuatu, Tuvalu, Fiji, Tonga, Tristan da Cunha, Reunion, and Easter rising again like the outstretched hand of the master that calms the storm. I can see him still as he takes the strain of the rope, feels the tug, lifts the mainsail smooth again. We embark on vast oceans, deserts and endless sky. Eyes level with the equator, we stand high on a world that opens and turns.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, we heard All Aboard the State Coach, that was by Jonathan White. Then we had New Beginnings by Zoe Devlin, followed by Lunch Blessing, a poem by Enda Wiley. Thackeray on Grattan Hill was by Lourdes Mackie. The Orchard We Didn't Rob by John McKenna. Earthed Lightning was by Grace Wells. And finally, the masterclass for Hubert Conaty, a poem by Tom Conaty. And this morning's music, Are You Right There, Michael, was by Percy French, and that was sung by Brendan O'Dowda. Inchworm performed by Danny Kaye. Coma dalla Molino by Roberto Murolla. Salut d'amour by Elgar was performed by Takako Nishizaki and Yanu Yonda. God Knows You Gotta Give to Get was by El Perro del Mar. And Open the Door for Three was by Liam O'Flynn. And a couple of books you may be interested in. Father, Son and Brother Ghost, a memoir, was by John McKenna, and that's published by the Harvard Press. And Drawing on Memory, a poetry collection by Tom Conaty, is published by Limerick Writers' Centre. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer, Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to the programme on the RTE Radio app, on the programme website or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.